And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Daniel Derda, our guest. Daniel, back to talk about this asteroid. What is it called? 2004 MN4, is that it?
That is correct.
Okay. What does the MN4 mean?
The M and the N are designations that really kind of tell you the sequence in which this asteroid was discovered in the year 2004. The two letters refer to the sort of like half month in which it was discovered. So
November 4.
It's in that vicinity. That sounds right.
Okay.
That sounds
so
right.
So month would be November 4. Well, let's see. The one I just mentioned, FN5, would be
It's pretty early, right? The first thing to be discovered would be, you know, 2000, like, say, for instance, 2006, you know, AA, right?
Yeah.
And then you go to AB, AC,
interesting.
You know, AD, you work through the alphabet, and you do go to, like, B, right? BA, BB, BC, and you work your way through.
MN4
is about the, you know, around the middle of 2004.
Okay, around 2029, it's going to come 20-some thousand miles from the planet, within satellite range.
It's amazing, yeah, when you think about it. This thing is going to fly closer to the Earth than our own satellites that we've launched up.
We're going to be able to really see this thing.
It's going to be actually a very good view in Europe, it turns out. We'll get the best. The actual closest approach happens at the time when it's dark time in Europe. And so for London, England, for instance, it will be up about halfway up in the sky. It'll be naked eye visible. It'll be, you know, well, of course, from London, I suppose, with any big city, you'll have to be away from the bright lights to be able to see the thing. But it would be actually naked eye visible. It'd be moving through the sky at something like, 2.5 degrees per minute. So, you know, it's not quite as fast as watching an airplane move through the sky, but it's not going to be stationary in the sky either. You will be able to perceptibly watch the object move through the sky as it flies overhead.
How big is it?
We're estimating. We had a radar observation of it, and it was the radar observation, actually, that occurred back, I guess it was around February or so, that actually told us that it was not actually going to impact us in 2029, but merely come close. That was the observation that refined its orbit. Unfortunately, that was a barely detectable radar cling from it, if you will, not enough information to get size and shape. Our estimates on its size and shape come from basically how bright it appears in the sky at a given distance, and we think it's on the order of 320 meters across, so, you know, about a little over three football fields across.
That could cause a lot of damage.
An object of that size, this is why we were so concerned. For the first time, this was big news.
It
didn't hit the news, but it was big news. It was wholly unexpected that an impact possibility during the lives of all the people that were discussing this could actually happen with that probability involving an object of this size. None of us expected to ever deal with something like this in our lifetime, to be looking at, you know, 1 in 30-ish, 1 in 20-ish odds of an object that could actually do some real damage to us impacting, you know, in our lifetimes.
Well, and seeing this one was found in 2004, we're right at the
we're
beginning.
We're going to see a lot more of these.
Absolutely.
We're going to see a lot more of these. What's happening is we're still, and 2004 MN4 is one of these objects that's coming along. We're getting it for free, so to speak, as we are completing the Space Guard goal of detecting all of the kilometer and larger, it's about 0.6 miles across, and larger near-Earth asteroids. We want to find 90% of those by 2008. And we're getting there. It may take a little longer than 2008, but effectively we're getting there fairly well. In the process, of course, of searching for those larger objects, we tend to pick up occasionally some of the smaller, fainter ones that come in close, and so we're getting objects like this for free. We are now talking because we understand that even these small objects can cause, you know, local to regional devastation. If they were to impact over your city, it's not a good thing. We're getting to the point now where it's becoming recognized that we need to actually complete a similar survey for objects 150 meters, 1.5 football fields and larger. When we start actually seriously completing and working on that survey, the bigger telescopes to find those even fainter objects, we're going to have this sort of, watching an object and you know, considering that it may have significant odds of impacting us a couple decades hence, we're going to have those happening several times a year. And we're going to have to learn how to deal with this. It's a the case of 2004 MN4 behind the scenes raised quite a ruckus amongst the asteroid community.
What would they have done if this thing was on a collision course with the planet? And honestly, Dan, sometimes I wonder maybe if it is, and you guys are being too nice to us, and you don't want to tell
us. You're hitting exactly the key issue that was going on being discussed among, because I mean, this was big news, but. I mean, partially because it was the holidays, partially because of the tsunami, it was just not picked up in the press. This was an absolutely unprecedented event in the history of searching for asteroids and thinking about asteroids' impact, and yet it never really hit the news. Now, in retrospect, it's probably good that it didn't, in a sense, because, you know, it clearly, subsequent observations show that it's not in fact going to impact us. But there's more to that story actually, so don't let me, make sure I come back to that. But, in the process there were some in the community that were saying, maybe some of this, we don't have to put out every little detail about this object, and let's wait a little longer and see what it's going to do before we say anything. Some of us think that's a bit of a dangerous way to approach the problem. I guess I count myself in the camp that feels that, information is good.
Full disclosure.
Yeah, exactly. I in this area, I would tend to want to make sure, this is how science works, this is how this process works. I think put all the cards on the table. Let everyone see how this process goes. We're pretty much there as it is. I mean, it is a very open process. There were some areas, though, of this particular case that were not so open.
Such as?
Well, such as a couple of us were
staring
at a
map. Is this what you mean by more to the story?
Well, there's actually even more to the potential of we have to still pay attention to this object.
Okay, all right, let's get back to this. So this is not...
All right. Some of us were staring at a map around Christmas time of not only the fact that this thing is, potentially going to hit us,
but where?
Some of us were staring at maps of where it would hit.
Mm-hmm.
And, without naming individual countries, some of us were looking at our European and Middle East sort of colleagues and thinking, there are places there where disclosed.
Can you accurately, if this thing were going to hit
us? Yes, at that time, we didn't know yet where along a particular track it was going to hit, but we did know the track.
Okay.
And that part was fairly well known. In fact, for this particular object, the uncertainty width of that potential track across the surface of the Earth where the object could hit, the width of that track was narrower than the actual damage zone that would have been caused by the impact. Okay?
Yeah, I'm with you.
So, some of us were staring at this and wondering, how much longer do we continue on this, had the new observations not come along and resolved the issue of, we're still staring at 1 in 37 odds of this thing impacting in 20 and 29, there was a potential that we could have been staring at those odds for months, if not a couple years to come, before subsequent observations would have been able to show. Now, we dumb lucked out, found an old observation that all of a sudden shrunk down this error ellipse, moved it off of the surface of the Earth, and gave us the all clear. But had, by dumb luck, that observation not been there, we would have been continuing, still to this day, right now, been sitting here with one in probably about of order 1 in 20 odds that this thing was going to impact across this particular track across the Earth.
Okay.
At what point in that process, and this is a legitimate question, I'm not telling you the answer, I'm legitimately asking the question, at what point in that process should our community have become, started to put that kind of detail out there? We in this community are constantly on the on the boundaries between, being Chicken Little, saying the sky is falling, being, crying wolf, and secrecy,
Well, and we've got too much secrecy already, Dan.
Where in this process should we err? I'll tell you where I fall. I tend to fall on the full disclosure. Let's treat it the same way we treat other disasters, other risks that we commonly deal with, hurricanes and geological risks and things like that, which are, you know, look at hurricane forecasts, right? I mean, you get a tropical depression that forms off the coast of Africa, and the National Weather Service, the National Hurricane Center, is already not only tracking it, but daily, hourly, automatically updating the observations of that tropical depression on websites that are freely available to everybody.
Well, and now they're beginning to tell people so they can evacuate.
Exactly. And but my point is that process starts very early on. We don't wait to start telling people, hey, there's something to pay attention to when it's already in the Bahamas. We automatically, so everyone can make their own decisions as to whether or not it's interesting, the information is posted. Now, to be fair, we are very nearly at that point in the process with these asteroid impacts. There are web pages that are publicly available from NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the Near Earth Objects Program Office. You can go there and look daily, updated automatically, the objects that are of concern. But there's information in there that you can take the information available there and go further. And the question is, should that further information, should we as scientists be communicating it in a more clear way, or should we just post the raw stuff and rely on other people's ability to maybe try to decipher it?
No, have to decipher it for us, frankly. I think you guys have to do that.
Well, that's kind of where my thoughts are, that's part of our jobs as scientists, is to clearly communicate what we do to people who aren't scientists and who aren't able to decipher that information. That's our job. That's what we do. I mean, it wouldn't be our job if we were paid by some private foundation or some wealthy benefactor. We're paid by public tax dollars. That's our job, is to make it clear and give back to our society that pays us what we're doing. I weigh on full disclosure. Let's put everything out there on the table. Let everyone on their own decide whether it merits attention or not.
Now, you were talking about then the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. Not to play Chicken Little, but it's not quite true that we're completely out of the woods here. There's an interesting quirk to
a little
twist
to
pass
to this,
in 2029.
What is it?
Well, anytime you have an object like this passing that near to the Earth, and actually there's two twists here. Anytime you have something of that size passing near to the Earth, Earth's gravity now starts to significantly affect its future path in the solar system, right?
Right. No doubt about that.
And there are little what we call keyholes in space. You know, if you pass near the Earth, you know, over here, you get twisted into an orbit that sends you into the future on one particular path that is of no consequence in the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It goes about its business. But if you were to happen to pass in just the right place past the Earth, through a little keyhole, quote-unquote, in space, the specific circumstances of that one particular pass might allow you to return to the Earth for a future impact sometime down the line. And that is indeed the case with almost any of these close patches. But with this one in particular, we now know pretty specifically that there's a keyhole that allows this object to enter a resonance with the orbit of the Earth, a 7-6 resonance. So for every 7 times that the Earth goes around the Sun, this object goes around the Sun 6 times. In fact, there's a little keyhole in space during that 2029 passage that would allow this object to come back and have a small chance of impacting the Earth in 2036, only 7 years later.
All right, so you believe at least 2029, we're out of the woods there.
We are out of the woods for 2029, and we're, you know, again, very likely that we're out of the woods in 2036, but
you're not sure yet.
But we don't know. We probably won't know until, you know, there's still this residual uncertainty in where this object is going to be in 2029, and we're not going to know that residual uncertainty any better by even into, you know, 2010, 2015. You know, I would like to know, even before that pass in 2029, I want to make sure that we don't have this object entering that particular little keyhole, small as those possibilities are. I want to know precisely where this thing's going to go. Our observations from the surface of the Earth itself are not good enough, I think, to give us enough forewarning before 2029 to do something about this object should it enter that particular narrow little keyhole. I think what this requires, I've been working with Rusty Schweikert, former Apollo astronaut.
Oh, yeah,
he and I
sure
are
thing.
He is the chairman, I am the president of the B612 Foundation, which is a group of former astronauts and space types who are very interested in this whole issue of how do we go about deflecting a near-Earth asteroid to prevent one from hitting us. Rusty's been working very carefully to understand what's going on with this object in the future. He and I are really trying to advocate the idea that relatively soon, as in, you know, in the next couple, 2 or 3 years, now, basically, we probably ought to be committing ourselves to launching a pretty conventional little mission to 2004 MN4, not a deflection mission, just a mission to emplace on the object a little radar transponder, which makes it much easier for us to track where this object is going.
Now, that's fascinating.
So that we know before, you know, around, before the 2029 close pass, we want to know whether or not it's going to go through that keyhole early, so that we have an opportunity before 2029, should the slight possibility occur that it's going to go through that keyhole, that we can actually have time to go out there and move it and prevent it from going through.
Yeah, how would we move it? What are our possibilities with today's technology? What could we do?
That's precisely what the B612 Foundation was formed to look into. We have been looking at the possibilities of using the technologies that NASA is generating for the new exploration initiative, the new Earth-Moon, Moon-Mars exploration initiative. One very promising technology is NASA's Prometheus program.
That they may have tabled because of budget, by the way.
The original flagship mission for the grander Prometheus project was a mission called JIMO, the Jupiter Icy Moons Orbiter. JIMO was going to be the first demonstration of the broader Prometheus project. It is now looking as though, indeed, JIMO was a little as valuable a scientific mission as JIMO still is. It just appears to be a little bit too costly, too risky, too big to do for the first demonstration. You want to do something simple.
Simple.
Something easy.
Well, I agree.
You want to walk
that.
Before you run.
You want it to work.
Yeah. You want to demonstrate. You want to learn. You don't want to do something so complex that you're going to completely doom yourself to not learning anything. We have been talking about actually using as an early Prometheus demonstration, the ability to go out and play with an asteroid.
Would you blow it up?
Not at all difficult. The energy budget to do it, in other words, the amount of fuel that you need to spend to get to a small near-Earth asteroid, the amount of energy that you need to use to do that is very, very, very much smaller than a mission to Jupiter. And so it makes it a much easier mission to do.
Would you blow it up? Would you try to move it?
No, we wouldn't. We wouldn't really do much at all with it. We would try to move it a little bit, not enough to actually. You know, what we would do is pick an asteroid. Now we're not talking about 2004 MN4 in this case. The sort of demonstration mission for the B612 project with Prometheus would be to pick a small near Earth asteroid that's in fact not in any danger of impacting us, and go out and see what we can do to move it and learn by doing.
Let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back, Dan. And also, we'll open up the phone line, so get ready. You've got the numbers. We'll give them out again in just a moment.